spend 9:20 on the dot. Maybe we should just make this our starting time. 9:20 every day. So here's the order we'll go in. Open the Senate Revenue Committee. We're going to do House Bill 2776 first. Then hopefully we'll work 479 and move that onto the Senate floor. And then talk about urban renewal on 412 and then do the House bills in order after that. So with that, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2776. Mary and Representative Butler.
Thank you, Senator Dankert, but Chair. House Bill 2776 engrossed eliminates the 2010 sunset date for the Historic Property Special Assessment Program, which has a 15-year term for each property. Subject to approval by the governing body in which the historical property is located, which is either a city or a county for properties located in non-corporate areas, the House bill enables owners of historically designated residential properties to reapply and obtain a second 15-year period of assessment. Special assessment. It repeals the special assessment when the property is either sold or transfers unless the new owner assents to the preservation plan in effect for the property. Under current law, the qualified historically designated residential and commercial properties are eligible for a 15-year period of assessment. The assessment is based on the value of the property on the application date into the program. For tax purposes, this value is frozen for the next 15 years, and assuming the value of property appreciates over time, it will be less than what the maximum amount would be over the period of time if it did not have this assessment. Subject to meeting the qualifying criteria and approval of the State Historical Preservation Officer, commercial properties are all currently eligible for an extended 15-year period of assessment for maintenance. The residential properties don't have that, and the proposal now will extend this for maintenance as well as just give new properties the option of going on to just an additional 15 years. It will also cover maintenance. In calendar year 2004, there were roughly 1,100 to 1,200 historical properties in the special program, of which about 640 were residential properties. The maximum assessed value and exempt values of these properties were about $425 million and $309 million, respectively. The estimated tax loss for these properties was roughly $6.2 million for that year. Enabling owners of residential properties who are currently in the special assessment program to reapply for a second 15-year period of special assessment will not substantially affect revenues during the 05-07 biennium because most of the 15-year assessment periods for these properties have not expired. If these properties are eventually recipients of the second 15-year period of special assessment, the frozen value of these properties will be based on the current market or M50 assessments, not the former frozen value, as opposed to that were assigned during the original 15-year period. Enabling owners of residential properties who were previously in the special self-assessment program to reapply for the second term could begin to affect revenues as early as 05-07. There are currently about 530 residential properties previously in the program. In providing you with the estimates on this bill, we obtained some data that we used to build an aging profile, so to speak, so that we weren't going to include in the estimates current properties that are in the 15-year program that still have another 10 years to go. We built that profile to exclude those entities, and then we took and made the assumption that they would reapply. Okay, we also built that profile into the number of entities that were previously, in the program that would reapply. The only real difference here, and while we've given you two sets of estimates, the bottom one is a maximum estimate, assuming that all property owners would reapply, and that they would be approved. However, the latter assumption really is not as tenable as I think it might be because it's subject to local action. So we just built in, for want of a better estimate, we took half and we said suppose half of the governing authorities decide they do not want to support the second 15-year term. They may want to maintain their current law, but they don't want to allow for a second 15-year exemption. Based on that, the estimates provided to you are about $500,000 for 05-07 and about $0.6 million for 07-09.
Chief sponsor of the bill, Representative Tom Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Tom Butler from House District 60. I wanted to express appreciation to staff for working with us and all those other folks who have come forward to work with us in the historic property. And I recognize, please, that the former program, which we've had, that's continuing program, basically has been replaced by a local option program. This is a local government option to approve these historic properties, and this replaces that program, which was actually sunsetting for periods of 15 years of non-transferable elections to go ahead by local option and approval by local government to apply for these the historic designation on your property. As staff has indicated, there's somewhere between 500 and 600 properties that are involved statewide in this particular program, or that could be involved in this particular program following the changes that are being made. Again, we appreciate the great work that's been done by local government as well as the State Historic SHPO, State Historic Preservation Office, in helping us to define some of the limitations. Recognize that where the 15-year is a non-transferable 15-year period, that the property then gets a step up if the new folks want to reapply for a new 15-year, that it would the updated values would come back onto the records. That makes it less lucrative than what the program has been in the past, but it also provides that those properties would still be subject to a fairly high level of oversight. We were able to introduce into the record that the standards that are provided for historic property under the U.S. Secretary of Interior standards, which includes preservation, rehabilitation, restoration, reconstruction, is an important element of maintaining these properties when they do come in for application or reapplication for a maximum of an additional 15 years. By using those standards, we feel like that local governments will still be able to attract people, attract tourists to their districts for these grand old champion historic properties that have been preserved and rehabilitated or restored and reconstructed in the fashions which are prescribed by law, and still be able to get some of the flavor as we attempt to try and restore and bring those properties back to their former grandeur and glory, but also to bring folks to communities where these properties are located. Again, this is a conglomeration of a lot of very good input and testimony from cities, from SHPO, from other governmental organizations, as well as the property owners in these historic districts that might apply to the local governments to have their properties frozen in value for a period of a maximum of 15 years and non-transferable. So I'd be happy to try and answer any questions. Your staff has done an excellent job in explaining.
Great, thank you. Questions for Representative Tom Butler? Yes, Senator Dorch.
Good morning. I look here and I see that you only had 4 no votes in the entire House, which is a pretty good affirmation that it was a good idea. And the implications of this are, when you have a historic property that's very expensive to maintain because it's an older facility, older building, obviously. How many of the properties do you believe actually would fall into disrepair if we didn't have an incentive to maintain that property?
Mr. Chair, to Senator George's questions, first of all, I think that that in part of the 4 no votes were that we were voting at the same time on a Portland option for historic issues that was getting a lot of traction at that particular point in the House, and there was some concern about overall issues of historic properties. I think that issue is separate and apart from this. This is a local option.
Right.
As to the question of the properties, my opinion of the properties that might go away, we had a number of folks come and testify to us that they were maintaining properties that were historic in value, but were not conserving and preserving them under the existing program, and would not continue to exist and keep them in existence as a historic property under almost any circumstances. The cost of maintaining them with the old standards, reframing a window with just wood single pane, just did not make sense where they could use much more efficient materials, much more energy, cost savings kinds of things that they would do. There are a number of properties that are historic properties that have no historic designation as to any of these kinds of things. That's because they've begun to make some changes in the integrity of the historic nature of the property. So there, you have to have, and visions of money pits comes before me as I think of this, you have to have a rather significant property to start out with, and number two, you have to have a rather significant financing capacity to go into one of these, because these properties truly, these folks are spending a lot of money at the local stores to try and just get everything just exactly right, whether it's the woodworking and or whether it's the stain and those kinds of things, to keep them absolutely. So they're spending the money. They're just not, and they're spending a lot more money than they would be saving on by freezing the value for a maximum of 15 years at a time. They're spending a lot more money, but it's a pride issue, and I think that if cities will encourage this, or zones within cities will be encouraged, I think that there will continue to be properties preserved in a historical fashion. But I think you're going to see less and less of these. I really do.
That's not good news.
It's just an unfortunate part of the world we live in, Mr. Chair, that because these are so expensive. And I mean, for the price of, and there's some folks that talked to us in the House side, and then visited with us from the historic district here in Salem. For the difference in the cost of a single pane window, it's much more expensive to leave it single pane. Number one, and number two, then the cost of the ongoing maintenance of a single pane with the cost of the loss of the utility and those kinds of things. It's just a very, very expensive item, and so you've got to have people that have a real outpouring of love for the property itself to do that, and that was part of the concern we had, was to use the federal standards for the preservation, rehabilitation, restoration, reconstruction of these properties as we go along, and to try and maintain them as best we possibly could. But those other people, and we have people in the audience today that have these homes that have bought these historic properties, but have decided not to maintain them to this high standard, that they're not using the opportunity to reduce the taxes, but they're still maintaining it. You know, from appearance from the street, it would still maintain that grand old grandeur and that integrity. But if you get right up close, you'll find out that there's some plexiglass used, and that there's some other kinds of the materials that are forbidden under the true restoration, rehabilitation, reconstruction, and restoration that you can't use to maintain them in this fashion. But I think this is a kind of a last window of hope for some of these areas where we do have people that say that home has been in the family for 100 years or will approach 100 years while we're in it, and we'll continue to maintain that. And this is a much smaller incentive than what it has been, but it's one that we could get everyone to agree on.
It's bankable, yeah. Other questions for Chair of House Revenue? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members.
Just Roger Roper, anyone else, because we pulled this sheet, that needs to or wants to talk on 2776? Okay, we're going to in just a second.
Good morning, Mr. Good morning. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Roper, the Preservation Programs Manager with the State Historic Preservation Office, SHPO, which is part of Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. And I'm here to speak on HB 2776A. The bill would make changes to the special assessment of historic property, the nation's oldest historic preservation tax incentive. The legislature considered similar legislation in 1995. At that time, the Revenue Committee looked at the issue of reapplications for a second period of special assessment, including residential property. Ultimately, reapplications were allowed only for depreciable property. The department has no objection to allowing residential property owners a second period of special assessment, particularly since preservation plans would be required. However, the department is concerned about the language in Section 3, which would disqualify property from special assessment upon sale or transfer of the property. And we're concerned with this provision for three basic reasons. First, it would apply to depreciable or commercial property, which was not the intent of the original bill. Second, preservation plans were not required until 1995, and thus there may be at least 5 years' worth of properties, commercial and residential, that would not be able to benefit from the exemption in Section 3, which appears on page 3, lines 2 and 3. In our opinion, this would create an unfair and unanticipated financial burden on property owners, since the value in property taxes would rise unexpectedly upon sale and transfer. According to our records, there are 214 depreciable and 445 residential properties statewide that could be affected by Section 3, so about 650 properties. The third reason we have concerns is that Section 3 appears to open the door for potential abuse by property owners who simply no longer want to adhere to the terms of the program. They would simply have to sell the property to a family member or a business partner in order to cancel the benefit and the obligation. Currently, if they choose to opt out of the program, they are required to pay back the tax benefit that they have enjoyed. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Did you testify in the House as to your concerns in Section 3?
No, we did not.
Because?
We were not asked to be part of that.
So you found the bill as it came over and then saw that you had objections to it?
The more we've looked at it, the more we've realized there are some concerns, yes.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Roper. So can you give an example of, I'm trying to picture how the problems that you pointed out that y'all have in Section 3, maybe provide us an example or two of where you would see this manifest itself.
Yes, Mr. Chair, there would be, say you had a historic house, that you got into the program, you liked the idea of it. 8 years down the road, you decide you want to sell it because maybe the land has become very valuable and you want to develop that property. This would, you could then simply sell it to your business partner, develop that property, tear down the house, and not have to pay back any of the tax benefits you enjoyed for 8 years. You're able to get out of the program simply by the sale of that property to someone else. We don't anticipate a lot of people doing that, but every once in a while, historic properties are attractive properties. They're often in valuable locations. And it just seems fair that if you take the benefit to begin with, that if you opt out, you would have to pay it back and not be able to.
You could redevelop the house. So you could redevelop it, tear down the house, put in a condo or two, and you'd still enjoy the tax benefits?
No, you wouldn't continue to enjoy, but you would have enjoyed those first 8 years.
First 8 years.
And just walk away with that money in your pocket.
Okay.
Sure.
Senator Brzezinski.
It sounds similar, I'm sorry to just walk into it, it sounds similar to like the enterprise zone type of scenarios where you have a company that's coming in getting the benefit, and then once that enterprise zone period runs, they basically pick up and move to another state. And they basically got the windfall, and that's what I've talked about throughout our session, is having that crawlback of like Austin, Texas. I think the state of Colorado had it, if they still don't, where they basically say, we're going to give you this benefit, but you also have to realize that we're expecting something in return, that's that you're going to stay here for some period of time, and if you leave prior to that, you're going to be obligated for whatever windfall you got.
Mm-hmm. Other questions, comments, Senator Dorch?
I just need a little bit more detail, Mr. Chairman. Once you have had that property recognized as historic property, is it that easy to get out from underneath that designation? I mean, in other words, I've agreed to go along with this and maintain this house according to the federal standards and the single-pane windows and everything else that's required exactly as it was. And then somebody can, you know, I can come along and under this thing sell that property and be absolutely free of what did you say, the federal implications of that designation as historic?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator George. You can opt out very easily of this benefit simply by writing a letter saying, I want out, and by then paying back the difference in the taxes that you would have paid. It doesn't get you out of any other regulatory oversight that may come through the city with their design review ordinance for historic properties.
Right.
You can't opt out of that necessarily, but you can opt out of this benefit because you voluntarily came in and you can voluntarily get out.
Could I do a follow-up?
Yeah, please.
What do you think the odds are in any given city in Oregon that a person could take a federally designated historic property and then completely eliminate it off of that area and put in condominiums? I mean, I would think that the chances of that are zero.
Mr. Chair and Senator George, I think they're higher than that. We work with historic properties all over the state, and there are oftentimes historic property owners who they're new owners to the property. They may not appreciate the historic value, or as we mentioned earlier, the land value has gone up so much that it's not something they want to continue to maintain, that old house on a valuable piece of property. So I don't think it's zero. I don't think it's really high. I don't think there's going to be a rush of folks going out to do this. But there are, we get calls weekly from new owners of historic properties that are in this program wondering if they have to stay in the program or not, and just testing the waters in that regard.
Mr. Orr, do you have suggested language for Section 3 that you think would disallow? I mean, the obvious one is that you just wouldn't allow the property owner, if they do redevelop the property, to enjoy the retroactive tax benefits that they received.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the simplest solution would simply be to not have that phrase in there, that the sale of the property would trigger disqualification from the program. That would be the simplest. Administratively, I have to say as well, if the sale of triggers the stopping and starting of the 15-year clock, so you're in for 8 years, and then we stop the clock, and the next owner doesn't want to be in for 2 years, does that mean we have 7 years hanging out there that we have to keep track of, and then a new owner, and then a third owner comes along and wants in, we start the clock again, and do they have to pay a new application fee? These are administrative things that we can certainly handle, but the seemingly innocuous phrase actually could trigger a series of administrative burdens on the program and really on the applicants as well, just keeping track of how much time is left in the benefit, how much should it cost for their application fee, and just tracking that on again, off again nature of it, because 15-year period is the maximum.
Senator Pazansky.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So basically what I'm hearing from your perspective, Mr. Roper, is that we should have a program that if someone opts into the program, they're in the program for the length of the duration. If someone wants to buy that property while it's still within that program period, that's part of the sale, that they are in until that time runs and extinguishes, and that would be easier for administrative purposes as well as the continuity of the program itself.
Very much so. And they would be able to opt out as well. The new owner could opt out, but if they did, they would have to pay back that tax benefit that someone else enjoyed, say, but...
Okay. Senator Stock?
This new information, I would very much like to hear the representative sponsor of this to respond to that information since he's still with us.
We are going to do that as soon as we get done with our questions for Mr. Roper.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments for Mr. Roper? Thank you. We always appreciate when a bill starts in the House, if folks have objections to it, if at all possible, to get them on the record there, invitation or not. It helps the process a ton to get those objections on the record as soon as possible. Representative Tom Butler. And team.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom Butler again from House District 60. I just, this is new information Mr. Roper bring forward on behalf of SHPO, but recognize that if you've got somebody that wants to live in one of these properties for 14 years and then convert it back onto, for no longer being a historic property, they've had to have expended rather significant amounts. I think the question that Senator George raises is the likelihood of this happening has got to be pretty close to zero. Now, could it never happen? No, it could happen. And also remember that the savings that someone will have enjoyed, because the property gets a step up in full value as to the real property values when they make the application or when they make the renewal or when they transfer the property, that brings the property back up to full value and the maximum that the property will have ever increased in value that they could have received. The freeze would just be the annual increases in the value of the property. Which money we anticipate, and we have information that they will have been expending well over that in the community for the maintenance and repair and restoration and updating this property. Again, this bill also provides for the continued inspection by the State Historic Preservation Office in this regard. So while we try and anticipate virtually every person that might take advantage of this, remember these are a very select group, a very small and a diminishing group of folks that have opted into the property and this optional value in the past, and these folks continue to maintain these properties in such a fashion that they're expending more, typically much more than they would have saved in property taxes back into the maintenance and upkeep and repair of these properties. And I've asked Michelle Deister from the League of Oregon Cities, because again, this is a local option issue, and if the cities felt like this was a terrible, terrible thing as opposed to a good thing, then I wish we would have heard from SHPO in the past that they thought that there might be some problem. And again, the maximum value that you could ever ascribe to one of these in the 14th year that someone would have received this long-term benefit would be only the incremental increases in the property values during that period of time. And because of the inspection provisions under the current law, they're going to have had to expended much more than they would have ever saved in property taxes, and so basically they would have been spending dollars to save dimes in that process. I just don't see it as a real threat to the program, but have encouraged Ms. Deister to come forward and express on behalf of the cities their participation in this and the overall coming forward of House Bill 2776.
And Representative Butler, just before, and who did you work with in developing this legislation? Obviously, the cities.
The cities and a number of folks were at the table. I don't know that I ever sat down personally with SHPO, but I know that SHPO was certainly consulted as we were going through, because we saw other historic properties at the table at the same time. We tried to meld and blend this program, excuse me, so that it would provide the maximum benefit for these historic districts in these cities, but still not remove property from the tax rolls for long periods of time in programs that get extended year to, 10, 20, 30 years at a time.
So they were aware, as this bill, SHPO was.
Yes, Mr. Chair, absolutely. They were aware, and this is a new concern. But I think, as Senator George has pointed out, you're straining at a gnat to swallow a camel to try and figure out how we can get somebody that would abandon a property after maintaining it to these high standards and abandon it and say, Jimmy, the property that I'm sitting on is worth a lot more if I just tear the old place down and build a condominium here. First of all, zoning has changed in such a fashion that to replace a single-family residence, one of these 8,000-square-foot, three-, four-story-high properties, to replace that single-family residence with anything other than a single-family residence is going to be a major, major change in law and zoning laws. I don't see that happening.
Would the city have to approve that if they did that? Would a city have to say, yes, you can tear this one down and Michelle, maybe you know the answer to that.
Mr. Chair, unfortunately, zoning and planning are not my forte, but it I would imagine that there would be some sort of...
I think his forte is walking up here.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Marge Gaffori, representing the City of Portland. Mr. Chair, I believe your question is if an owner wants to tear down a federally designated property, is it, it contains the federal designation?
One of these, yeah, one of the properties outlined in the bill.
Federally designated historic properties are exempt from owner consent. As you recall, there is a section of statute that requires owner consent for a designation at the state level for a historic property or at the local level for a historic property, but that owner consent does not go along with federal designation. So the answer to your question, I believe, and Mr. Hamrick is here to correct me if I'm wrong, is that the local government would be able to intervene if there is a federally designated property that is threatened with a teardown.
They would. The answer is yes, they would. I want to tear down my historic property. The city can come in and say, what's the plan here?
At the very least, we can negotiate with the owner. We may lose in the end, but we have 120 days to negotiate with the owner on an alternative plan. That could be something like removing the building in total to a new site. It could be something like offering another kind of incentive to the owner to preserve the property. Those kinds of things could take place.
Questions for the panel?
And help.
Thank you. Michelle, did you have anything else?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michelle Dicer, League of Oregon Cities. I just wanted to speak briefly to the original intent of the amendments to this bill that passed out of the Revenue Committee. What we're hearing, I guess, from SHPO is that what we intended perhaps did not necessarily come to pass in the actual drafting of the bill, and that's unfortunate because we did try to keep them in the loop in terms of what our intentions were supposed to be. The intentions just were as follows: to maintain the sunset so that you could periodically review whether or not the historic property special assessment should continue to happen. Require that if a second 15-year special assessment plan were to be approved, that it requires a new preservation plan. That was an important point of agreement for all the parties. All of these changes were only supposed to apply to residential, and I'm hearing that perhaps in drafting that didn't turn out to be the case, that commercial accidentally got folded in there as well. And in terms of the sale of a property, the idea was that if it was sold and the new owner did not agree to continue to maintain that preservation plan or did not file a new preservation plan, that then they would not be receiving that tax benefit. So that was the goal of those amendments. And to the extent that there are technical issues, I am hoping that that's something that can be resolved.
Mr. Chairman, James Hamrick, I'm Assistant Director at Parks for Heritage Conservation. We were at our budget hearings, Phase 3 budget hearings, so I'm sorry I wasn't here earlier. We were asked basically to participate in the amendment writings for this the current bill that's before you. And notwithstanding what Ms. Dicer said, we did in fact tell her that we had problems with the fact that the sale and transfer thing would affect commercial properties. The thing we didn't do was to relay this to Representative Butler. And when the bill went out of committee during work session, we did not basically no comment was solicited from the audience, and we basically didn't bother to tell Senator, Representative Butler that we wanted to say something, so it's really my fault. But we noticed this problem with the commercial properties early on and did, in fact, bring it up. And frankly, I think notwithstanding any of that, we can make this work if that is, if you all want to go with the current version of it, we'll make it work. It's not going to be. It will just create some administrative difficulties, as Mr. Roper mentioned, but it's not going to be the end of the world for us. So.
Okay, this is not the best day for the Parks Division. I'll just say that by coming in at right before Bill's about to move to the governor's desk or to the Senate floor, there's another public hearings in the House given to this bill, and just we so appreciate when folks get to the sponsors early and let them know. What I think we'll do, any questions? Yes, Senator George.
What I'm looking at, the new language in Section 3, and that's where your heartburn is, right? Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, yes.
When I read this, I don't get the conclusion out of that. Now, would you help me to understand this correctly? Because it indicates to me that new owner must expressly, if they're going to continue the benefits, they must agree to the plan. How do you get out of that, how do you get to the point of tearing the building down and putting condominiums in?
Mr. Chairman, if under Section 3, it says that upon the sale or transfer of the property, the special assessment ends. And so, as we mentioned in our testimony, there are X number of properties that don't have preservation plans because they weren't required before 1995. So we have some 600 properties that could, if they're sold or transferred, special assessment ends and there's no other responsibility either to pay the back taxes or other. Under the third part of our testimony, that essentially anybody who is under special assessment can now apply to have it removed and apply to have it torn down. It's not basically anything that nothing in our programs prevents, has any impact on local land use or regulations. So if somebody is under special assessment now, they can apply to have it removed, pay the back taxes, and if they want to tear it down because of its highest and best use, they can apply to the local jurisdiction to do that. And most preservation ordinances are process-based, and so if there is a demolition provision in it or demolition review in it, then they just have to basically go through that process at the local government level. City of Portland does have a demolition denial provision in their particular ordinance, but it's not necessarily, it's one of the few in the state that does.
Good. So current law provides for that, the possibility of a demolition. What would be the change that you're seeing in here that would make that worse as far as the potential of a destruction of a historic property?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I think that if there were any changes basically that we would like to see relating to Section 3 is that it not apply to commercial or depreciable property, because I don't think that was the original intent of the original bill that went through Representative Butler's committee.
Okay. All right. I've got it, sir. Thank you.
Great. Any other thoughts or questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate your time. So what we'll do on this, Representative Butler, we're in no hurry, so we'll move it next Wednesday or Thursday. We'll give you a chance to talk to these folks and make a decision on what the next step, but we'll set it for a work session Wednesday or Thursday of next week. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2776. Thank you, Mary. Let's do Senate Bill 479. We are so all aware of this bill that I don't even think we need a eight or nine hearings on this. And ready to move. We're in work session. Katie or Mr. Yates, do y'all need to be ready for us to move? Yes.
I'm ready to move this bill.
Is this the dash four
I'd
doing?
Like to.
Is it the dash four that we're looking
at? Make sure we get Senator Starr, I'm going to recognize you in 1 second, but Mary, if the dash fours are the...
Yes, it adds a provision that nuts exclusive of seeds and grains will be added to the list of food products for which processors will be exempt on their purchases of newly acquired or new machinery and equipment that's used in the processing of those items, with some clarifying language. And the revenue impacts are there for you, less than $1 million in 05-07, 07-09. We refined the analysis, actually. The numbers came down a little bit from the dash 3, even though we added nuts to the set.
And these are local property revenues.
That's right.
Make sure you put that out.
Okay. Correct. So, Senator Starr, yes, it is the dash 4s that are in front of us.
I would move the dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 479, Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr has moved the dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 479. Any discussion? Any objection to that? Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 479 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 479 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Metzger.
I just want to express my, it's kind of a nostalgic thought with this bill at this moment, because I'm going to miss Mr. Yates, who has just almost been like an addendum to the Senate committee here this session, in the audience, for 4 or 5 months. And I know this means the end of our relationship, but very much appreciate his patience and companionship through this session.
I've gotten a little stronger carrying this big bill file every day in the committee with me. I actually feel an increase in my stamina. So it's been helpful in that one small respect. Other discussion of this important bill? Any objections to moving Senate Bill 479 to the floor with a due pass recommendation? Hearing none, so orders. Who was the sponsors? Was Beyer the sponsor?
I think it was Senator Beyer. I believe it was.
Senator Beyer, carry that bill. Open a... I'd like to have Floyd here for urban renewal. Do we know where Senator Brzezinski is? Let's open a work session on Senate Bill 412. Another bill we're very familiar with, which is the urban renewal bill. We passed it out of committee with, and the big issue committee we have before us, and I think the decision point we have today is, do we keep the opt-out language? When we passed out the bill, we had that opt-out language for special districts such as Place and Fire. Obviously, when it made it to the floor, it lacked, our colleagues didn't see it the same way we did on that issue, and so that's the issue before us, whether we keep the opt-in and the opt-out language. Mary?
Sorry, we have another amendment from Senator Schrader as well.
Okay.
We had the opt-out provision, which we took out in the dash, it's actually the dash 5 that's before you. It says basically we took out the phrase that said the governing authority might exclude special taxing districts from participation in the plan. That would be their option to consider that. But we also have a dash 4 amendment that Senator Schrader has drafted for you, and this basically takes the A engrossed, which was the bill that had the opt-in language, right? It kept the language that allowed governing authorities to exclude special taxing districts, but it also moves back into the dash 4, the elimination of school district taxes from the division of tax method of funding. So we've got two amendments to consider.
Thank you. Let's have maybe one panel talk about pro opt-in. Mayor Williams, do you want to talk about the A5s first, since that's somewhat of a separate issue? And my feeling on this one is if we do keep this opt-out language, that we would adopt the A5s too and just add schools to the list, if that's the direction we go today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is not a new idea for me. I've been struggling with this thought of why schools should be penalized by urban renewal and the way it is, the school funds that is. And that was the reason why I urged Senator Schrader to help me think about it and eventually get some legislation that might address it. So the original bill for was intended only for school opting out of urban renewal. At your request, we proceeded to use the bill as a mechanism for doing other things about urban renewal that might be appropriate. And the fire districts, special districts, were to be considered. I got busy with some other things. I didn't follow exactly probably as closely as I should when that happened, when the accident happened about opting the schools out of the bill. And I, to say the least, was dismayed because the original intent of the bill was to deal with schools and help them in some way. The state school fund, where I believe, by my calculations, that at least $33 million this year is going from the school fund into urban renewal districts around the state. That's just my own calculation. I'm not a mathematician, nor do I understand all the nuances of school bill formulas and all the rest of it. But it's been millions of dollars over the last 15 or 20 years, $300 million maybe. It's gone from school funds into projects which may be useful, in some cases are not useful at all. And so I urge that you put school back into the bill, that schools have the option of opting out. The option, not the requirement, as the bill was first written, but the option that they can look at. This in effect does what you and I talked about originally, Mr. Chairman, was that urban renewal needs to have more transparency. We need to know where the money comes from and where the money goes. I was just looking at my own property tax bill, and there was a misunderstanding about that in the beginning, I think, that on Clackamas County tax bills, at least, urban renewal just shows us one amount, and you don't know if you're paying that directly out of your checkbook into urban renewal or what, but in fact, it's not. It's coming from the Port of Portland. It's coming from the schools. It's coming from the county. It's coming from the city, and you don't see that. So you don't know where the money you think is going to schools is coming back into urban renewal. Even in Oregon City, before the two sessions ago, when they changed the law of the division of taxes on special elections, the school bond for $60 million that we passed in Oregon City, $200,000 a year on that school bond is going into urban renewal, and that's not reimbursed by the state. What they did is a little trick. They added on an extra check of taxes to the taxpayer so that taxpayer actually paid the $200,000 a year that must be paid out of this school bond fund. So that was my concern, and I would urge you to put the schools back in, at least give them a chance to talk about this in public, and people can see what's happening to school money. Thank you.
Thank you. And if any questions for Mayor Williams?
Sorry.
Senator.
If you have a deteriorating central core district and businesses are fleeing, which many small cities do, and you have an urban renewal that comes in and says, we're going to revitalize this area, and what's going to happen is, of course, much investment's going to come in here, and brand new business generation, the renewal of your downtown district, all the jobs that are created, the managers that are brought in, the investment and everything else, they're going to buy homes in your community, values are going to go up everywhere else around. Do you see this thing coming up with a balance in the end when, in fact, the new investment generates revenue outside of the urban renewal benefits that will equal the loss that you have in order to enable that to occur in the first place, that urban renewal?
Yes, sir. I understand that proposition. But, in fact, what happens in smaller towns, I believe, maybe not in Portland. That's why I suggested maybe in the original hearings, maybe there's two sets of rules maybe you have to apply here. But let's just take an example in Oregon City where the only really economic development program that's gone on directly specifically to build new buildings for business is called the Red Soils District. It cost the city about $5 million by the time they got through paying off the loan and the help and everything else and went into creating the streets to build the buildings. It's now worth about $22 million, this total little complex. Mm-hmm. Well, in Oregon City, if you apply the tax rates to that $22 million, you get $120,000, $125,000 a year. Well, how long does it pay off? How long does it take to pay off? $5 million at $125,000 a year, it takes forever. And on top of that, any values that might have been created around the complex are only raising at 3%, which they would have naturally anyhow. So in the smaller complexes, it doesn't seem to work. Other than that, there's been no direct economic program started in Oregon City over the 20 years of the program, and all that time the money's been paving roads. Good idea, I suppose.
But how does it benefit education? Because, and on top of that, they don't end. The urban renewal agencies don't end. Take Clackamas Town Center, been going on forever. And it's now been extended another 10 years, so the schools, anybody else, is not benefiting from it. All the money is going back into urban renewal. So it, in the case that I've looked at, urban renewal doesn't work in the way in which it was intended. Now, I heard the Portland people argue about, well, it does create values all around and jobs and all that. But let's again look at red soils in Oregon City. Suppose 1,000 people do work in the complex. Were they all unemployed before the complex was built? Were they all Oregon City residents before the plan was built? If they were Oregon City residents and were unemployed, then they bought a house, maybe it works. But probably, if they worked in lived in Oregon City, they had a job, they had a house, and they're already paying their taxes. So there was no net increase in the city's benefit to that. It may have benefited from some businesses, and they look nice, and it sounds good to have Benchmade knives in Oregon City selling knives all around the world, but yet, as yet, after 20 years of urban renewal, there's been no benefit passed on to the schools. So it looks to me as though urban renewal in our setting did not work at all in the school and the city itself. In fact, the diversion of, I guess I'm getting beyond the subject here, but the diversion of money from the general fund of the city itself has driven us almost into bankruptcy. If that money had been left in the city general fund that goes into urban renewal, we wouldn't have the complicated financial problems we have right now. And I don't think that's been studied or looked at very carefully in terms of, at least, I think so. I think that. Does that help at all?
And Mayor Williams, you were a part of this work group that we had.
Yes.
With Senator Brzezinski and Senator Starr that
yes.
worked on at least the contents of what came out of.
But I did not know about the last session that occurred. I was not there, and so when it went out, I didn't know that that had occurred.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Brzezinski, Senator Starr, any comments before we're going to have two quick panels here before, but y'all worked very hard, at least, in wrestling with this issue, which is a tough one.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, from my perspective, I glanced at the A4s and A5s. I apologize. I had called out on another emergency, so I did not hear what the differences are. My review of them, though, it looks like the dash 4s would basically take the school districts out of the urban renewal and allowing them to continue their taxing as they currently may be doing.
It gives them the same rights that would be afforded to the special districts in terms of that ability to petition the granting agency, whether that's PDC or the city of Astoria, the ability to go to them and say, will you opt us out?
I think the school district eliminates it. It doesn't give them that. It doesn't give the ability to opt out. And they are able to. They're eliminated from
urban renewal.
Can't hear you.
Right. Yeah, you have to. Mary, go ahead. So
I think that Senator Schrader's dash 4 or dash 5, dash 4, I should say, will allow them to will eliminate school tax districts from the division of tax method, whereas the opt-out provisions we were excluding in the dash 5 deal mainly with the special districts, right, and the ability of a governing authority to consider whether it would like to exclude them from the plan. So I think the elimination of the school districts amongst stronger statement.
Yeah, what I'm hearing from Councilor or staff is that the dashboards will actually put up a complete elimination of school district taxes from the urban renewal funding and then leave the option in under the dash A's that we have, the engrossed bill with the option for the local taxing authority to decide whether or not to opt out special districts.
That is correct.
And then the dash 5 would return us to what?
The dash 5 is simply the bill that you adopted before, except we're pulling out the provision that says the local governing authority can decide whether or not it wants to exclude special districts.
Okay.
And it doesn't address schools at all.
Okay.
So advocating for the A5s, let's bring up, I have someone from the business community. Joe, do you want to represent kind of the business perspective? Michelle, who do you want the cities? Is she in here? Someone from the cities. Oh, Mayor, he is. I didn't even see you back there. Okay, so here we will hear from those who would like to see the A5s adopted, which would remove the opt-out language. Mayor Hughes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to address you today. It has always kind of struck me as a general comment that one of the difficulties, one of the disconnects that we all have from local governments to you guys is that we often wind up down here listening to horror stories about what happens in one particular city, asking you to pass laws that affect the whole state of Oregon. And I'm here at least to give you the very brief story of one of the success stories of urban renewal and why I don't think it would have happened under the proposed language in Senate Bill 412. And that's the story, and I'm sure that Senator Starr and Senator Decker are both familiar with the Rondler Acres story, at least in brief. We took a several hundred acre failed housing development back that was platted back in 1954, and in 1989, we created an urban renewal district, used the increment to buy all of the lots, replatted the land. The northern half became the Intel Rondler Acres site, which is now currently has 4,000 to 5,000 or 5,000 to 6,000 jobs that average about $100,000 per job. The southern half became a housing development called Orenco Station that's been featured in architectural magazines all over the world, and in fact in architectural textbooks. The bare numbers, we took $8 million off the tax rolls. We denied the ability of ourselves, the county, and special districts to tax that $8 million in 9 years. We spent $36 million on public improvements, and we returned just over $612 million back onto the tax rolls in 2001. That kind of an investment was a good investment for everybody involved. There's a couple of reasons why I think it wouldn't happen with the opt-out provision. One is that the risk for the city in making the decision is, even on a case like that, is a very narrow, it's a close decision. You have to realize that you're risking actual capital coming in now with the hope that you will do two things. One, provide a public benefit, and two, that you eventually will bring more value back on the tax roll. And making that decision with the possibility that at some future date, anytime there's any kind of what is a major change, that we would then be asked or pressured to withdraw some of the special districts makes that risk that much more uncertain. And just as I think I testified the last couple weeks and before my own body on the strategic investment plan for Intel, the goal of the SIP is to remove uncertainties. We have very few tools at the local level to do the kind of economic development that we've done in Hillsborough. Those 6,000 jobs at Intel's Rondler Acres have created about 18,000 other jobs in the community. All of those jobs are jobs that pay somewhere between $65,000 and $100,000+. All of that income tax then comes direct benefit back to the state, who then fills the holes for the school districts anyway, which is why it somehow doesn't make any sense, even as a feature of 30 years, to extend that to school districts. But the other part, some of the details that would have not been reasonable. At one point in the negotiations with Intel, they said, we'll bring the jobs to Oregon if you will build the streets. And we had to say to them, we will build the streets, but we don't have the money under the increment yet to build the streets, and we can't build them as fast as you want them. They said, we'll be willing to give you $5 million of our own money on a loan to be paid back out of the increment. Again, those kinds of risks that private partners were willing to make have to have some certainty to them, and the certainty is not there if you provide for some future opt-out so that some of that revenue is not going to be coming in. So I would urge you to take the opt-out out of the rules altogether.
Thank you. Questions for the mayor. So, Mayor, this was answered like a very simple question that we have when we put it in was, all the city of Hillsborough would have to do is just say no. And why what makes that, and perhaps it is, I haven't served in local government, what makes that so difficult?
Mr. Senator Decker, and I and members of the committee, I would, as I listened to the previous speaker, my response to him would have been, why don't you change the leadership of the city? If in a case where you've got a city that is not conducting themselves as the citizens would believe ought to happen. I think the concern that we would have, again, it goes back to certainty. I get to be mayor for another 4 years, and we don't know who's going to follow me. We don't know who's going to follow the councilors that are termed out. We don't know what their ability to be appealed to by one of the special districts to opt out. Now, I would say in passing that for Hillsborough specifically, because we're a full-service city, the problem is less than it would be for other cities. But there is pressure. We can't guarantee with a certainty to Intel, for example, that the increment is going to come in as we think it will come in if future councils could then grant opt-out provisions to other folks. So, again, it goes back to that question of certainty. That, you know, and again, it's certainty on one of the really few tools that that local governments have to use in order to provide the kind of financing necessary to create these kinds of projects.
Mr. Schweinhardt?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Schweinhardt, Associated Oregon Industries. The reason I'm here, I iterate what the mayor had to say. You know, we can pull out any given city that's had problems, and there's probably other circumstances involved. But urban renewal has been a major device for cities and communities to use to prompt, to push for new development. It's an advantage for the cities, and it adds to these special districts where property values go up, jobs are added. It potentially increases other values and other jobs and other people coming in the community, where it just makes it a better community to live, and it looks a better community where people want to locate. I think when you start looking at trying to cut the whole situation, the whole plan apart, then you start having problems. And I'm surprised somewhat from a business standpoint that anybody would want to opt out of something that I see as potentially beneficial to community long term. And that's additional property values, additional taxes, additional jobs coming into the communities. Yes, there's a lot of people that are complaining, and a lot of people are having problems with the schools may want or need more money, but this is just not the vehicle to do it. This is a tremendous benefit, economic benefit, for cities across the state, as well as neighborhoods in the Portland area. I mean, this thing is used everywhere, and it's been used for a long time. And I think it's proved itself over time. And to let people opt out at this point, I think it's taken a step backwards, and I think it hurts the cities, it hurts the communities, and it's going to hurt that small business that potentially can grow. It's going to hurt the economic value as we start looking at long term.
Thank you, Senator.
This is either for me or news or for Joe. You have an economy and a community that is maybe just dormant. I guess maybe a way to describe it. Maybe we've lost bills or something like that, and we want to attract a brand new kind of business or industry or retail into our community. And so we have a vision as to what we want to accomplish. And so we come out and we say, okay, we're going to do an urban renewal. We're going to offer these benefits. And so people will express an interest in possibly coming to your community. What happens as far as at that other end where the people are looking into that community and they see the possibility, as you mentioned, that there is not surety? I cannot be guaranteed that the deal I think I'm going to negotiate will in fact be the final issue. Therefore, do I even move toward your community, or do I go to another state or another area that in fact will offer me that surety? In other words, up front, I know this is what I can, the city's going to say to this individual, that's what I know what I can offer you. Is that real? I mean, are the people looking at that question very seriously? I would, if I was going to make a major investment in an area.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, our experience in Hillsborough in terms of the kind of recruiting that we've done, it's a fine line as to success or failure on most of these companies in competition with everybody from Albany, New York to Shanghai. And what makes the final kick is always a little bit hard to predict. But I really believe that that what we have accomplished in Hillsborough, we've been able to accomplish with, again, if I had to say one term, it is the term certainty. We have certainty in our land use laws, and I spoke to the committee when you were up in Hillsborough about the need to retain the certainty in our land use laws that we administer locally for that reason. We have certainty in terms of the financing, in terms of the SIP, and in being used for companies like Intel, and we have the certainty in the urban renewal tool that the money is going to be available to do what we promise we're going to be able to do. And I would agree that it is that certainty that gives us a competitive edge over several other parts of the country that have allowed us to be as successful as we have.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I agree. I think when you start looking at this is just another piece of an economic puzzle that can help these communities bring business in or keep them there. There was an article in today's Statesman Journal about the climate worsening for small business across the state. And I think we're in a situation where if these communities, anything we can do to help them needs to stay in place. And letting people opt out doesn't get us there. I think the other part of this thing is that when you look at what it costs, potentially cost, you've got to look at, you can't focus on one part of the value of it coming in. I mean, you're talking about jobs long term, you're talking about potential business, you're talking about growth in the community and the benefits to the community as a whole. I think it's difficult to quantify that sometimes, but when you weigh that against the cost, I think you're seeing that the cost becomes minimal over time, and it's a great benefit to the community. So,
can you just do a quick follow-up?
Yeah, we are.
Getting shorter.
I want to make sure we get 29:50 in here before.
Okay, that's okay.
But please, we'll do one last question.
So, if I have an option of the person that's going to bring me these $65,000 to $100,000 a year jobs, and no person bringing me $65,000 to $100,000 jobs, the option seems very clear. I mean, one, I have a chance of getting money all the way down this. All the other issues is they make investments, buy homes, buy property, whatever they do, of getting those tax dollars back because of the fact that there's so many new dollars going out in the community. Do you guys see it that way? I mean, that is the basis of this, is I'm going to get it back because of new money that's basically in the community.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, you're right. And what we can't see, we can see those jobs come back. What we can't see is the ripple effect. If we get somebody does get a small plant or something that's an advantage to the city, how does that ripple in the community? Maybe another company comes in later. I mean, the potential is there. Like I said, this is just one part of that, but the potential is there for it to grow the community's economic value, economic stock, and that's what the communities are looking for.
Are you? Yes, Mayor Hughes.
No, I was passing, Senator.
Oh, you're passing?
I thought I answered the question perfectly well. So.
Yeah, no, this panel's been very helpful. Yes, good morning, sir.
Good morning. Thank you, Senator Deckert. Ladies and gentlemen, Larry Peterson, Economic Development Director of City of Hillsborough. I wanted to make a very brief comment because I know you're on a tight timeline. In addition to the political uncertainty that Joe and Mayor Hughes mentioned, there's also the financial uncertainty of opt-out as it affects your bonding capacity for an urban renewal district. And if you have an opt-out that affects cash flow for a district, you're going to impact either the cost of money, the amount of money that you can bond, or the length of time over which your financial capacity must, is in place. I mean, Rymer Acres Urban Renewal District in Hillsborough's experience was extraordinarily successful because there was a full flow of funds that retired the bonding capacity needed to do our projects in about 10 years. So I think if you start pinching cash flow, you're going to have a serious deleterious impact on both the amount of money and the cost of money that you can put towards bonding for projects in the districts.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate the,
thank you, Senator.
The support of the Dash Fives.
Thank you.
The opposition to the Dash Fives. Hasina, do you want to bring up a panel and maybe we'll go for 3 to 5 minutes and then we'll take a vote on this. And then next bill we'll do is House Bill 2950, and if we have time, we can excuse from the floor, which is starting now. Well, it doesn't really start now. We'll try to get 3358 in if we can. So just a brief...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. I will defer all of my comments to Alec Jensen, Executive Officer from Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, who will be representing the position of Special Districts Association of Oregon, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, and also the Oregon Fire District Directors Association, which represents a significant number of elected officials throughout the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I will try to be brief. I'll tell you what frustrates me so much and what has frustrated me about this is this seems to be a debate about the benefit of urban renewal. We think urban renewal is great. Okay, let's be clear about that. And we have no shortage of examples of where urban renewal has done good things for our communities and good things for the state of Oregon. This is about local control. This is about placing a tool in the toolbox of cities and counties when they consider the creation of urban renewal agencies that they don't have today. Just responding to a couple of comments, Mayor Hughes seemed to, he implied that there was the opportunity under this bill for periodic opt-out. I want to be clear. Decisions get made right out of the gate. There's no provision in this bill that allows for anybody to opt anybody out into the future, so I want to be clear about that. Again, I'm just trying to be brief. I think you've heard our pitch. You've heard it time and time again. The thing that I really don't understand, and I'm not a professional lobbyist, so you'll forgive me, the thing I don't understand is what is it about the opposition that they can't trust themselves to make the right decision? You know, this is placing the decision in the hands of the cities and counties. If we can't make a compelling case as another local government that we should be opted out, this gives us no more authority than we have today. It simply puts the decision in their hands to weigh it. Echoing what you've heard from Mayor Williams time and time again, this brings an element of transparency to the discussion about urban renewal that simply doesn't exist today. And Chair Deckert, that was your issue from the very beginning, is increased transparency. So if I sound frustrated, I apologize. I just don't get it. It's not about whether urban renewal is good or bad. We think it's good. We just think there needs to be another layer of discussion. We think local governments ought to have a tool they don't have to have today. It's all about local control. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. A good defense of the bill as it stands. Questions or comments for this panel? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So, committee, we have a choice. You know, one question, can I ask Mr. Jensen or just one of you? One of the difficulties we had is when we sent this bill, it didn't have 16 votes. If we kept the bill as a whole, can you give us the assurance that it has 16 votes?
We can give you the assurance it had 16 votes as of yesterday.
As of yesterday.
Who knows what
that's
happened.
A long time in this process.
I can tell you we're feeling pretty optimistic.
Okay. Committee, what is your pleasure on this? It's a pretty clear question. The dash fives remove the opt out. Not passing the bills as a whole would obviously keep it.
Mr. Chair. We have three options here at this point. One is leaving it as is without any amendments.
Correct.
And that would do what? That's, if I remember correctly, that has the opt-out for the special district.
That is correct.
And everything else y'all did in your work group.
Right.
The opt-out is not
mandatory.
That needs to be clear.
Right. That's it. Permissive at the local level. If we take the fours, we retain that option for the special districts, but we take the school districts out of the special districts. Is that correct?
Out of urban
districts
renewal.
Districts are not in special districts.
Out of urban renewal.
Mm-hmm. All right. And then the fives basically gets us to the point where there's basically status quo, meaning no opt-out, no elimination of districts. School districts in that case.
Yeah, the school districts would stay as they always have. Status quo, correct, and the dash fives would take that permissive, as Senator Starr points out, opt-out language out of the bill. Or we can do nothing. Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I've agonized over this thing from the standpoint of saying, well, gee, that should be something they would be willing to consider. But then on the other side, I'm looking at this fine line that was just described to us a few minutes ago as to whether a person is going to, whether we can attract the kind of people we want to bring those high-paid jobs to our community, and realizing that it is a fine line, and if, in fact, not passing A5 would be a discouragement for that investment in their time, as Joe pointed out, which I don't believe we're having a significant recovery, then I think that would be very detrimental to the state. So to provide the local jurisdiction with the ability to say, we're going to offer the full meal deal here in order to not undermine the bonding potential, and then also to be able to offer the maximum incentive for those good-paying jobs to be brought in. I think, to me, that is so critical that we be able to tip that balance slightly towards investment. Mm.
So for the A5, it's just mm-hmm. a slight advantage. Any other comments or thoughts?
Well, this has been a struggle for me, Mr.
It's a hard one, yeah. It's a really hard one.
And it would be a lot easier if all of their renewals were successful in Hillsborough. Paid back in 10 years and back on the tax roll with millions of dollars of extra tax base. That's pretty successful. They're not all that successful. What happens if we don't pass a bill?
Yeah, that was my question, too.
What happens if we don't pass a bill?
We don't have to. It's just the work group that you were part of. There's other things that were included that I thought were some good language adopted just on urban renewal, some modest reforms, but I thought helpful reforms.
Mr. Chair.
Not world-changing, but good reform of the urban renewal system and some of the, I guess, excesses that we see, and I think there are some out there of excesses. We at least put some, I guess, walls around some of those really tough situations that we see with urban renewal that would be in the bill if we passed the A5s.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
It appears that maybe there should be another option or two on the table based on what I'm hearing here as we are struggling. Maybe this is the part that the locals are having problems about taking on the obligation of deciding whether or not to opt someone out or not. And I'm wondering if we shouldn't consider maybe the other work that the work group did and just have that as one of the options. I do have to say, though, the elimination of the school districts, the one thing I haven't heard, I know that the first of the panels talked about everyone benefits from this, but I find myself looking at how we are not funding schools right now. And this is one way that we potentially allow whatever money's going into the school system to actually stay within the school system. And yeah, they get a benefit where they didn't actually, quote unquote, have the requirement of not having their tax base frozen during that period of time. But it seems to me that's one heck of a community investment in making sure that schools continue to be able to educate the students to be making up the workforces that we need to fill these new jobs that we're talking about mm-hmm. in the future. So, I mean, I was somewhat surprised when I saw the A4s, not knowing exactly what that meant, but basically it has the ability to take them completely out of that picture. And, and the stuff about special districts, I've had, I don't know how many conversations with how many people in this room that come to lobby on this. I look at the local control issue as it's again one of those tools in the toolbox, and we have decisions that we have to make under pressure, being having advocacy from other sides, and I'm not sure why it's not fair to allow the local control to have that same opportunity. And so, I mean, I look at these now, and I could pretty much go with anything if we feel that we need to move a bill out. And if we need to move a bill out and you want to do it today and we get a motion, I'll vote based on the motion. But if you want to look at structuring maybe some other options, that may be make it more comfortable for the vote for the committee. Clearly, at this point, I'm hearing split votes and whatever we throw out.
as a I think we're probably all in a similar position. We all supported the opt-out language unanimously. The only problem was, and because this is such a difficult issue, and the cities obviously care deeply about the outcome of this, they did a good job of convincing our colleagues, and it's certainly complicated as your work group learned and as we've learned as we've sifted through this. Having not heard that they have 16 votes, my preference would be then to move the dash fives and keep the contents of the bill. Because what I had told the special districts is if they had 16, we would move the bill as it is, without hearing that they do have 16 votes. To me, at that point, it makes sending out the bill without the dash A5s not an option, because I just don't want to send out a bill again that everyone on this side of the room then goes and fights, and we have a bill that just doesn't have the support. It's the only one we've sent out that didn't have 16 votes. We sent it out. So I guess my preference would be then the dash A5s, so reluctantly, but I think that's where the bill, if we want to keep the contents of the good work that y'all did, I think that's the way you get it.
I have one comment. It's just thinking out loud, knowing how things are going in the latter days of the session. I just was wondering out loud, we've talked about the votes for the existing bill that we thought we had and then obviously eroded when it came to the floor. Although I do wonder if we take the opt-out out, you know, Senator Schrader and others, I wonder if we have 16 votes for the A5. I mean, has anybody tested that? If we do the A5 and say, okay, we're not going to have an opt-out, I'm just wondering, has anybody checked the temperature that the body would vote for it the other way?
Mr. Chair, I know that you'd like to move something today. I'm going to ask the chair to not move something today. Let's set it for the very beginning of next week, because if we think that the board, or I'm going to say the special district language, is what's caused us some problems, maybe what the one of the other individuals in our one of the other members brought forward as to taking care of the schools, maybe we should look at that as an option by itself without the special districts. I mean, that's one of those things that
You want a big fight on your hands. I mean, I'm happy to hold off. I mean, we've had this for 4 or 5 months. It's a tough issue. We can hold it for another week as we close down. I mean, we have literally had this bill before us for a couple months, so my intention was to either put it up once and do something with it.
Right.
I don't think it'll get easier by next Wednesday, but I'm happy to do it. I don't feel a huge marriage to any, but I do think the contents of what your work group came up with was worthy of, although you're the two chairs, so I'll follow your lead on this. If you'd like a little more time.
Let's give it some time.
Okay, so we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 412, open that public hearing on House Bill 2950. As Representative Flores, please, ma'am, come on up from
can
Ben.
If there was an exhibit, I don't know if it was going to take it or not, but I can drop that off in your office if you want to consider what's going on with urban renewal, how much of its total imposed tax is that district are actually going to urban renewal,
Mary.
Other districts, and here are the school districts.
I'm going to let you lead off because you travel a great distance to be with us this morning. And we're hearing House Bill 2950, sponsored by Representative Flores, and appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Lynn England. I'm a certified public accountant, and I also have a master's degree in taxation. I have a small local accounting practice. Its structure is an S corporation, and we have a Section 129 plan. Other of my history that may relate is that I'm a mother and a grandmother, so children are very important to me, and dependent care, I think, is a real important issue in Oregon. We need more quality child care in Oregon, and a lot of work has been done around quality indicators, around education, and that's all in place. What's not in place is the dollars to pay for it. It costs more to provide quality child care than middle-class employees have the ability to pay. Involving employers with the leverage that a Section 129 plan allows with tax credits and the attributes associated with that is one way to leverage those dollars. And so I think that's a real important thing to have in place. I believe Oregon should not subject Section 129 contributions to unemployment tax. Oregon currently, by default, includes them in the definition of wages and therefore taxes them for unemployment tax. They're not wages. They're fringe benefits. They're employers paying employees dependent care. They are like employer-paid medical insurance or an employer-paid pension plan, neither of which are included in wages for unemployment taxes. The federal government does not include them in employment taxes. Oregon does not include them in taxable wages for income. But I think as an oversight, they did not get excluded from the definition of wages for unemployment, because it's a very inclusive definition. Unless you have a specific exclusion, you're included. Okay, that donut you get at coffee in the morning is part of your wages for unemployment, unless there's a specific thing that excludes it. They are clearly distinguishable from Section 125 contributions for dependent care, which are subject, understandably, to employment tax at the state level. The difference is that a 125 plan is a cafeteria plan. The employee says, take a piece of my wages that I have the choice of getting in my paycheck or having you take and buy dependent care with. Okay, so this is wages. They are choosing not to be paid and having the employer use to purchase child care. A 129 plan is the employer paying out of the employer's pocket for the employee's child care. Okay, there is no option to get the money. It's if they qualify, and 129 is, you know, a big code section in the Internal Revenue Code. It has many hoops to jump through. It is not for the employer's children. I have my children, although they are all grown, but if I had young ones, they could not be included in the plan. It's not for the employers to give themselves another benefit. It is for the employee. And it, because of other tax attributes associated with it, is a very good way to leverage dollars into child care. I have put here on my notes that the federal government and other states do not include these payments as wages for employment tax. I do not know that no other states include them. I do not have that comprehensive knowledge. I used to practice in California. I know they're not included there. Federal government doesn't include them. I believe most states do not. I don't know if we're the only state that does. I do know that if you read the instructions to the employment tax reports for Oregon where you figure your unemployment tax, you would be led to believe that they are not taxable. It is not clear. What it says is generally wages reportable for federal unemployment tax purposes are reportable for Oregon unemployment insurance tax. That is incorrect in the case of a Section 129 contribution. But there is nowhere in the instructions that it tells you that. So for a big company like Nike that has a big payroll department and lots of knowledgeable staff, that's probably not a real big problem. They know that. They know how to deal with it. For the little employer, it's a big problem. Their payroll clerk is not going to know that they have to go and read the actual statute to know whether it's taxable or not. They're going to look at the form instructions, and they're going to do it wrong. And potentially, and I've seen it happen, they're going to get audited and slapped with back taxes and penalties and look bad in front of their employer because, and I have talked to two of the auditors that audit for the employment department, neither of whom understood what a 129 plan was. However, they're technically correct. The law as it's currently drafted, they are included in the definition of wages, and they are taxable. But I think it's this confusion. Like I said, I honestly believe it probably was initially a drafting oversight, that they are not excluded because even the auditors that do these employment tax audits don't know what to do with that.
In both cases, they thought they were the same as a 125 contribution, which they clearly are not. This is not money that was coming to the employee anyway. This is an employer benefit plan that they may be able to partake of if they meet the requirements. That's real. I think it's needlessly complex for employers, especially small employers here. And also, it kind of leads you down the garden path the way things are done right now. My understanding is that Oregon's unemployment reserves are sound. This isn't a big revenue area. There's no real reason to single out this one area of fringe benefits to be disconnected from the federal government on. And quality care is very needed in Oregon right now. This is a way to get some dollars into that. Oregon has been working. They've hired people to go out and outreach to employers, small employers included across the state, trying to get more employers involved in assisting their employees with dependent care. And I have done some speaking to various chamber of commerce groups, also to some other tax professionals in this area. And complexity is the big problem. The little employer looks at it and thinks, oh, this is big and complicated, and they're afraid to get involved in it, even though the dollars look good. This is an area where we're adding complexity for really no good reason. Many software, payroll software services assume that the definition of unemployment tax per state is the same as federal. You can make them work, but it takes additional entries and time and energy for the payroll departments to get them to come out correctly for Oregon and correctly for federal, your payroll stuff. I think as a part of our encouraging employer involvement, it's important that we just clean this up and put an exclusion in for Section 129 payments. This is not a broad general thing. It's narrow. 129 has restrictions as to amount. It has restrictions as to care providers. As I said, it's not okay to just give it to the owners of the company. In fact, the owners of the company, I believe, have to be excluded. And it's not a benefit for the wealthy. It's a benefit for the middle class and the parents of Oregon. And it's needed. It's mm-hmm. very needed.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Questions for Ms. England? Thank you for coming and traveling from Bend, beautiful city. Hopefully it's sunny over there. I'm not sure it's here.
It was when I left.
We shouldn't move the capital of the Bend, but I wouldn't mind if we had it there every once in a while. Tamara Brinkman, are y'all in support of the bill?
Neutral.
Neutral? Not unless you want to. Are we ready to? I like this bill. I think it's a good idea.
I just had a question about it. Just curious.
Sure.
Is this by any chance covered in that Reconnect bill with all that other stuff that we had?
Chairman Deckard, and basically, I think it is clear to make sure you're all aware too that the employment department doesn't connect to all the federal law changes that go on in Washington, D.C. each session like we have in the Reconnect bill. And that Reconnect is connecting with the federal law changes pertaining to taxable income. And this is not a definition of taxable income. It's a definition of wages. And so that really is where the disconnect, and there was a lot of confusion when we first heard this bill in 2950 in the House as far as what was federal law treatment. So basically what has been clarified from the Employment Department is, yes, under federal law, these dependent care expenses are excluded from wages. Now we are going to be conforming with federal law and it making it easier. But it will be a loss in revenue and it will be a reduction in the other funds. So that's what you're seeing in the revenue impact statement. It's not general fund, it's the unemployment insurance trust fund. So that's what your loss in payroll taxes are. But it's just clarifying a disconnect in federal law, but recognize this is not the only disconnect in federal law here in Oregon in the employment statutes, because they have their own
definition of wages and they, you know, make effort to connect to federal law changes, but to say they're getting them all and that we're, you know, uniform, that's not true. So, and that's what the Employment Department had testified on the House side, is that there are other incidences in which Oregon is not completely connected with the federal. It doesn't have a role in reconnect by any means like we have with the federal definition of taxable income and that kind of thing we've had in the past.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Just quickly, is the statement correct that Oregon's reserves are sound and there is no reason to single out this area for disconnect?
Yeah. Senator George, you also have that bill, remember, this right. session, which, you know, lowered those rates because we had a sufficient amount of reserves. Right. So this is not going to have an impact at all as far as the overall solvency of that fund.
Tamara's shaking her head, reassurance of that. Other questions or comments or thoughts? Close public hearing, open work session, House Bill 2950.
Madam Chair, I move, or Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I move the Aid Growth House Bill 2950 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2950 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections to that motion? So, Senator Starr, would you like to?
I'd love to carry that.
Carry that bill. One other bill. Who do we have here for 3358? Let's open a public hearing on 3358. We won't move it today, but we'll do our public hearing on it. Great. That's Jana Jarvis from the Realtors Association. And let's see who's...
I'm dragging John Fletcher.
Mr. Fletcher is going to join Jana from Housing. No work session, just public hearing today on this bill.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jana Jarvis representing the 15,000-plus members of the Oregon Association of Realtors. I actually today am here with a different hat on, however. I'm a member of the Oregon Housing Lobby Coalition, which is a pretty broad-based coalition of business interests, bankers, mortgage bankers, home builders, us, as well as my friends I endearingly call the poverty advocates, who represents a lot of low-income housing interests, as well as Oregon Housing and Community Services, who participate in that work group. And we have for some time been talking about a number of issues related to housing and specifically home ownership. I think if you attended our presentation in January or February, early in the session, we talked about the fact that Oregon's home ownership rates are declining, and are actually declining rather steadily. In the testimony I provided you with, you'll see that we've fallen from 30th in the nation in the 70s down to 42nd in 2002, and I've heard, I don't have my hands on the statistics, that we've fallen to 44th in 2004. So the point is that we're going the wrong direction. House Bill 3358 addresses a very narrow segment to address that need, and it expands a program that Oregon Housing and Community Services has in place already for home ownership will allow low-income home buyers, 80% of median income, to also get a tax credit for dollars that they save for down payment assistance. Mr. Fletcher is probably better able to discuss the program should you have particular needs, but primarily House Bill 3358 is addressing that additional tax benefit. And the idea behind it, of course, is to expand home ownership opportunities so that we can begin to reverse that trend. And I will turn that over to John and address any questions you may have.
Thank you. Good morning.
Chair Deckert and members of the committee, for the record, I'm John Fletcher with Oregon Housing and Community Services. I'm a policy analyst and the government relations representative for the department. As Jana said, this bill is targeted for a very narrow group of Oregonians to help with home ownership. And the Housing Lobby Coalition isn't just interested in this narrow group. They really would like to help home ownership across all income levels. But this session, they wanted to start small. They wanted to start, I guess, at the bottom and work up. You wouldn't want to start with the richest people and do things to help them with more home ownership. So they're starting at the bottom. Next session, I think their intention is to come back with something that hits a little more medium income range to build upon this, but this is like the first step to work on the home ownership issue, and it's starting with low income Oregonians. they decided rather than to reinvent the wheel to look at programs that were in place, and they talked with our department about what we have in place or what things could be done. A number of different options were looked at. But if you've not had any familiarity with the individual development account program, this is a pretty good program. It's been in place for a few years. It started with a law passed in 1999 by the legislature, and it's been in operation. Probably we've had 3 good years of kind of a pilot stage, and we're now moving into a more full-fledged program implementation across the state. There have been about 500 people that have been through the program so far. And the way the program works is instead of just giving low-income people money or assistance in some way, this program has 2 additional features. One, it sets them up with a caseworker to make sure that they're saving towards goals that are important that will help them in the future. That could be education. That could be starting a business. It could be for home ownership. But the individual development accounts are set up, and a plan has to be in place for what the funds will be used for. And then they get matching funds for every dollar that they save in these accounts, which helps the assets in those accounts grow much faster. And typically, three-fourths, roughly, of the people participating in this program currently actually use the money for home ownership. That's one of the biggest needs that people have, and it's also one of the best ways over the course of many Oregonians, their best way to build wealth or build assets over time anyway. So this program is in place today, and it's been in place. We work with partners that are in the community action agencies. We work with housing authorities. We work with fiduciary area organizations that actually house the accounts. And the program's working well. The bill that's before you doesn't revise that program, just adds on to it a little bit. If they use their individual development accounts for home ownership, a $2,000 credit can be given to the person who actually did the savings, up to $2,000. It's a way for them to help recover some of their closing costs or some of the costs that they may have had on a down payment when they actually go to buy a house. So it helps make a program that's working well just that much better for this narrow segment of low-income Oregonians. Typically, it's 80% area median income or less.
Thank you very much. Appreciate all the hard work you've put into this bill. Any questions or comments?
I just have one real quick question I'm just a little confused about. This is for primary residents, but the tax credit can be claimed by the non-resident. How can you have a primary residence and be a non-resident? I mean, isn't that part of the definition? I'm trying to think how that works.
Chair Deckert and Senator Metzger, this tax credit language was crafted by legislative council, and it's typical of how they word that credit. In practice, the individual development account program eligibility doesn't apply to non-residents anyway. So, in fact, that problem that you mentioned would not apply here.
But I think it is common language that they will have in those tax credits, as a non-resident has to have the opportunity to be able to take this tax credit. You can't distinguish a residency on being able to be eligible.
So next hearing, if we could have Dexter or someone come and just make sure that we know, that we're clear that a non-resident couldn't actually...
Well, no, but that's the issue, Chairman Deckard, is that right. The council will tell you a non-resident has to be able to have the opportunity to take this, but it's just they're saying that the program will not allow them, but he just can't write the language such that only residents can claim it.
That's so weird.
Senator Bozanski.
Yeah, it sounds to me, I guess the scenario, how many people that would qualify for this would not be living in the residence that they're taking as compared to living somewhere else and then claiming ownership in another place. And so it sounds like the programs themselves have certain qualifiers, and the program does not allow a non-resident individual to apply for this program?
Chair Dickert and Senator Prozanski, that is correct. We were required to keep that language as far as crafting the tax credit, but the program requirements, the way the program works is that no one can just walk in and set up these IDAs on their own. They have to be pre-qualified, and part of the rules that we have for participation, they have to be a resident. So effectively, non-residents would not get into that situation.
Great. Maybe we can just have Mr. Johnson give us this very quick
Dexter, took him 2 seconds.
Analysis.
You and Dan, thank you very much. Really appreciate the bill. Dexter, I think we got it, but we'll have you give us the official blessing of we have it right.
Mr. Chair and members, Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council Office. The issue is whether, how can you have, if the bill requires that the primary residence be in Oregon, why do we have all that non-resident language? And the answer is actually that the U.S. Constitution requires basically equal treatment between residents and non-residents for tax purposes. So you throw that in there, even though the requirement is that their primary residence be in the state. That's fine.
Constitution always gets it.
Who gets to explain that on the floor?
Your fans, I guess, just wrote that stuff down.
Great.
Anyone else? Close public hearing on 2950. We are adjourned. We have a Friday meeting tomorrow.